All Out War is a wholeheartedly entertaining read for anyone who enjoys political histories with lessons to be learned along the way. It provides a swashbuckling account of the events leading up to the British referendum on membership of the European Union, held on April the 23rd, 2016. April the 23rd, now known by those who regard themselves as patriots, as Independence Day. And the aftermath of a drama which has not yet ended. The author is one of Britain's most successful journalists and gossip columnists, who can now add the writing of a bestseller to his achievements. Like all successful journalists, Tim Shipman is driven by sensationalism and the drive to reach the top ratings at breakneck speed, beating the clock for his deadlines while displaying his virtuoso skills through inside knowledge and cheeky tales from behind the scenes and on the spot. As a modern journalist, he is also adroit at joining the dots of confusing statements, implications, and rumour in brief and pithy anecdotes. His view of politics seems to be that it is much like a stage, even a melodrama, a public clash of egos, much more than a combat of ideas or ideals. Shipman obviously takes great pleasure in revealing what who said to whom and what played its role when in the unfolding of dramatic events. It helps that he is evidently an incorrigible gossip. His interest in intrigue and twist of political plot does not flag over 622 pages. Shipman's stress on the importance of personalities in politics means that he is more inclined to believe in capricious twists of fate driving events more than any grand design or conspiracy. Early in the book, he quotes with approval Steve Dupré of the New Hampshire GOP, who told him, "In politics, before considering malevolence, assume incompetence." Shipman's journalistic career extends over a wide political span, from the deputy political editor of the Daily Mail to political editor of the Sunday Times. The equivalent for Americans might be a career move from a top post working for Fox News to one working with the New York Times. That is no mean achievement, and Shipman seems to have made astonishingly few enemies getting to where he is, a testimony to an ability to socialise and network intensively whenever it served his career, without provoking antagonism. He could only have prospered in this kind of journalism by keeping promises and being seen to be honest, which lends strength to the plausibility of his account of events in this book. Politicians may fear him, but they do not bandy the word liar in association with his name. His flexibility and dispassionate approach to politics has also enabled him to write a book which is more like a military dispatch, note the title, All Out War, than a serious political analysis. And this war correspondent holds a press pass valid for both sides of the front. All Out War is subtitled The Full Story of Brexit, a subtitle which I consider a misnomer, and on two counts. Firstly, Brexit had, at the time of the book and at the time of writing this review, not taken place. Many enemies of Brexit and some supporters have been speaking about the results of Brexit as though Britain has already left the European Union. So strong is the shock and impression of the referendum result that people are second-guessing what will happen years in advance and half-deceiving themselves that it has already happened. Secondly, because the campaign, the result and the struggle to overturn it, is an ongoing story, something which Shipman well realises himself. Did he try to stop his publishers from using this erroneous subtitle? His book does not end at April the 23rd. Maybe Shipman will write a sequel, The Return of the Empire, perhaps? The confusion and drama which has taken place since Independence Day would warrant one. All Out War is written in the style of a thriller. W.E. Johns's Biggles, say, or Ian Fleming's James Bond, or the bestsellers of Jack Higgins. Each chapter of All Out War ends on a cliffhanger, compelling the reader to read on. It is what the critics would say, unputdownable. Here is a typical chapter end. Coetzee responded in his broad South African accent, "Oh yeah, shit." The word pronounced shit. The eavesdropper was disturbed by the final exchange. "That was the moment," I thought, "we really are fucked." Shipman's chapters are also put up in thriller mode: the coup, the deal, turning points, the Waterloo strategy. What we have here is politics as soap opera, more Game of Thrones or Dallas than the sober study of a political upheaval. This Twitter and Facebook influenced rollicking account of intrigue, betrayal, joy, and triumph, with its huge cast of dramatis personae, is, after all, a reflection of politics in our time. Politics has become as capricious, personalized, short-sighted, spin-obsessed, pragmatic, and media-driven as Shipman makes it out to be. He is as much a product as an observer of our times. It is a considerable feat, the kind of feat which our times expects from its amoral, hectic reporters. In Shipman's case, to rush out a 600-page book half a year after the events he describes, while holding down a high-powered job at the Sunday Times, not forgetting that he is the writer of the New Statesman Diary, not to mention the time-consuming networking which his work demands of him. Even allowing for the fact that most of the book is probably taken from his notes made at the time of the events it relates, this book is an energetic tour de force. Shipman likes to tell his story as though he had heard from leading players firsthand, or as a fly on the wall, which cannot always be true, but Shipman is so immersed in his blow-by-blow account that he probably can hardly distinguish between being there himself and hearing from someone who was. This opening paragraph from a chapter entitled The IDS of March is a good example of Shipman's style. No one had seen David Cameron angry in a long time. "You have behaved dishonourably," he spat. Some claimed the words "you shit" also passed his lips. It was just after 9 a.m. on Friday, the 18th of March, and Ian Duncan Smith, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, had just informed the Prime Minister that he was resigning from the Cabinet. It was a month into the referendum campaign, and 2 days after George Osborne delivered a crucial budget that Cameron hoped would give the Remain side a boost. Yet now a former party leader was quitting in disgust at the same budget, with a parting shot that seemed designed to destroy the credibility of the Chancellor. Cameron was furious and did not hold back, launching into an expletive-laden rant. Is this any more than a political history written in the style of a Jack Higgins? Does it hold a message for political wannabes or for anyone who aspires to alter the course of political events? I believe it does. Early in his account, Shipman brings in a well-known quotation from the 1950s. Apocryphal, like Nietzsche's Beaten Horse in Geneva, or Goethe's More Light, but no less the powerful for that. When asked what is most dangerous for a politician, Harold Macmillan, British Prime Minister from 1957 to 1963, is said to have responded, "Events, dear boy, events." This is the lesson of the book, and a lesson to be taken to heart by anyone involved in politics of any kind. The lesson, namely, that best calculations can be confounded by accidents, coincidences, improbabilities, and freaks of fortune, unfathomed depths of human ineptitude, and on occasion, courage and resilience. You cannot, by definition, predict the unpredictable, and the unpredictable can always happen. Can David Cameron have been reasonably expected to know that EU leaders would be so stubborn and blind to their own interests as to refuse to give him even alibi, pseudo-concessions, which he could take home to Britain and persuade thereby the undecided that he could safeguard British interests within the Union? Shipman reports that one female Conservative Member of Parliament burst into tears in public when the Prime Minister announced the obviously worthless, minimal concessions he had obtained after negotiating with Brussels in the run-up to the referendum, because she had been torn between her misgivings about the EU and her loyalty to her party leader, and she realised, to her dismay, that Cameron could not provide her with the concessions she desperately needed to hear. Now she had no choice but to campaign against him, hence the tears. Shipman's book is full of such psychologically laden instances and insights. They provide a warning to those engaged in politics. Do not neglect the human factor with its conflicting loyalties, hidden weaknesses, subjective inclinations, and aversions. Could Cameron have been expected to foresee the abrupt late decision by the charismatic former mayor of London, Boris Johnson, to throw in his lot with the Leave cause? Shipman, of course, has ginned up on the personal element, as though he were present as a fly on the wall. That same month, Ben Wallace visited Johnson in Tamar for lunch. They cooked a couple of steaks and drank a memorable bottle of 1970 claret. Johnson chose the moment to take his pro-EU campaign manager into his confidence. "I must warn you," he said, "that I could always recommend that we leave Europe." How could the Leave campaign have reckoned with the murder of a prominent Remain campaigner hours after the Leave EU group's controversial anti-immigration posters appeared on billboards? The message is, never be so confident as to be complacent, so pessimistic as to be defeatist. For good or ill, do not be too sure. Events, dear boy, events. A second lesson to be learnt from Shipman's book is that there is more natural justice in political developments and outcomes than many, especially, of course, those on the losing side, may allow for. Individuals, and not just key players, affect events. The Index of All Out War provides column after column of names of the people featured in his Brexit thriller. I have never heard of most of them. I doubt whether many of Shipman's readers have heard of most of them. But they all had their contribution to make to the events that unfolded. Shipman hints strongly that he believes that David Cameron was punished by his overconfidence. The Prime Minister had successfully fought two referenda and was confident that he could win a third. But history does not repeat itself the same way, and the Scottish independence referendum was nothing like the EU referendum. Interestingly, Shipman also states that among Cameron's miscalculations was a personal shortcoming, a deficit of imagination. He could not imagine that MPs in his party would put personal convictions above personal loyalty to him. But in many cases they did, and this ponderable psychological insight of Shipman's is a refreshing counter to the oft-cited cynical maxim that politicians always put career and personal loyalty before conviction. Cameron had reason to feel pleased with himself at the beginning of 2016. The 2015 election had confounded the polls' expectations and returned a Conservative government with an absolute majority, so that Cameron was no longer obliged to share power with the rival Liberal Democrats in a coalition government. The loud anti-EU party, UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, was stalling and was even reported to be losing members. Its leader, Nigel Farage, had failed, thanks in large part to a ruthless, no-holds-barred campaign against him by the Conservatives, there were even rumours of voting fraud, to win a seat in Parliament. The more radically nationalist and racialist BNP, British National Party, had folded into insignificance. The Scottish Nationalists had egg on their face after losing the Independence for Scotland referendum, prompting their charismatic leader, Alex Salmond, to resign. The Labour opposition was riven with a bitter wrangle between moderates and paleo-socialists over the leadership of the party. It must have seemed an opportune moment for Cameron, Shipman muses, to fulfil the party manifesto pledge, the one which had promised a referendum on Britain's membership of the EU not later than the end of 2017. Cameron, reports Shipman, aware of the delicious irony, did not want Europe to define his premiership. There was a strong warning voice. George Osborne, Cameron's friend, ally and Chancellor of the Exchequer, had been opposed to the referendum pledge from the start and did not share his leader's assurance of victory, and argued that the party should not honour its pledge. But there was no damping Cameron's confidence and perhaps, who knows, sense of obligation too. I am reminded of another fateful moment in history. Robert E. Lee, had he made a pledge to President Jefferson Davis to knock out the Army of the Potomac by December, deciding on a frontal assault at Gettysburg and Longstreet's fearful warning, "Sir, I do not think we can take that hill." One notable aspect of a campaign not short of incident and not lacking in the outlandish was the fact But not two major groups campaigned in the in-out referendum, but four. There was the Conservative-dominated and well-financed Britain Stronger in Europe, and there was the Labour Party's Labour in for Britain. In a mainly unbiased account, Shipman lets his pro-Remain sympathies show here, not quite concealing the resentment that many Remainers feel to this day that Labour's insistence on running its own pro-EU group and its refusal to share a pro-EU platform with Conservatives, subsequently neither properly supporting nor funding its own organisation, all this along with the lukewarm, even ambiguous support for a Remain vote from the new socialist leader Jeremy Corbyn, fatally played into the hands of the Leave campaign. Corbyn's lack of energetic commitment to the Remain cause caused great resentment among Remainers. There were also two groups on the Leave side. Vote Leave, which was supported and led by well-known establishment politicians such as Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, and Leave EU, which was financed by the millionaire Eurosceptic Aaron Banks. The two groups were involved during much of the campaigning in their own civil war and heartily despised one another. The question posed by this double division is how destructive is division on the same side in politics? Looking at the Remain campaign, it is easy to argue that it divides strengths, creates an impression of disunity, wastes resources. Yet viewed from the Leave perspective, it may be seen as a source of strength. Contrary to what some people believe, division and splits are not necessarily damaging. They may even be a source of strength, and there is a good case for arguing that the split in the Leave camp actually helped to increase the Leave vote. What Shipman's book makes very clear is the considerable influence exerted by the impression made by personalities, by dramatic performance and showmanship, on both the public and on wheeler-dealers behind the scenes. The perceived image of personality, irrespective of policy, played an important role in the referendum. The Vote Leave group may have had trouble currying favour with parliamentarians and businessmen if it had included rowdies like Farage or extremists like Galloway or Labour outers in its ranks. It did not have to do so because such people migrated to Leave EU. Similarly, the appearance of Conservatives like Johnson or Grove campaigning for Leave in Labour heartlands, arguing the case for a free-trading, profitable UK outside the EU, far from being helpful to the Leave cause, might even have been counterproductive to it. As it was, both major Leave groups were able to focus on their core subjects, free trade and immigration, and target groups linked to those subjects, and leave it to the other group to field discussion on their subject. The ruthless professionalism of both sides is a tribute to the energy of those involved. This too carries a lesson. If we care about something, we are enjoined to fight for it. Life is eternal struggle, said Nietzsche, the distinguishing characteristic of the life force itself being struggle. Struggle is not a manly addition to life or evidence of a full life. It is what defines life. It is the soul of life. An abandonment of all struggle is quite literally death. So there is more justice in victory and defeat than we sometimes allow for. Neither side in the course of the referendum campaigns, as described by Shipman, had very much time for bemoaning their lot. The referendum galvanised them to a struggle which gave them hardly time to draw breath. Shipman's account is full of interesting observations which can be applied to other fields of conflict. Here, for example, is a comment on Dominic Cummings, the organisational brain behind Vote Leave. Farage had opined that Cummings did not understand the importance of the immigration issue, but Shipman dissents. These, Cummings, writings, show that he did understand the issue, particularly its linkage with the strain on the National Health Service. But in 2015, his priority was to get a fair hearing from the media, and that involved downplaying immigration. That remark would not go down well with non-compromisers on immigration, but uncompromising nationalists were hardly heard during the referendum campaign, and Dominic Cummings was. This inconspicuous character, Shipman describes him thus, few people would have given the scruffily dressed man on the bicycle a second glance as he pedals between offices and coffee shops during May 2015. Dominic Cummings never wore a tie, preferred Converse trainers to work shoes, and with his high forehead and wire-rimmed spectacles had the air of a middle-ranking civil servant on an away day, if your idea of a civil servant is of a hedge dragged through a man backward. Who, according to this account, was not much loved, this prêt-à-manger coffee-drinking nerd, opposite in character to the gregarious, deep-drinking, party-loving Farage, turned vote leave into a relentless, efficient, number-crunching machine dedicated to just one target, winning the referendum. Quitting the EU had been a consistent priority of every nationalist or racial nationalist party in Britain from the moment the country joined the common market. But it was not they who drew up the agenda. It was not they who either took the referendum to the forefront in the first place, and no nationalist party played a significant role in either referendum, except that the Remainers in the first referendum themselves cited Sinn Féin and National Front statements in favour of leaving as an argument for nice people to vote to stay in. Cummings and Farage, profoundly different characters though they were, involved in very different approaches to winning the referendum, had one quality in common. They never allowed idealism or purity of belief to distract them from their hard-headed determination to win what they, as well as Shipman, regarded as a war. The subplot to this referendum was the demand that only a British government be able to decide for itself who had the right to live in Britain. This has far-reaching implications, of course, and explains why internationalists are determined, and at this moment, 2017, working to overturn the referendum result. The great British public is obviously unaware of the subplot. The extent to which the actors in the campaign, and for that matter, Shipman himself, were similarly unaware, is open to question. But of Joe Public's indifference to the broader implications, there is little room for doubt. In the general election, which was held at the beginning of 2017, the UKIP vote tanked. This could not be interpreted as remorse by the voting public, for the two major, entirely EU-committed parties fared very badly too, and leading Remainers, Nick Clegg and Alex Salmond, were not returned to Parliament. The message here from Job Public seems to run something like this. You've heard our opinion about more open borders and love thy neighbour. We don't like it. That's enough Brexiting from the lot of you. Now let's get back to normal politics. Job Public does not worry about the long-term issues. Keep it sweet and simple, mate. Demographics, independence, democracy. Sorry, I haven't got all day. The next book, Brexit, subtitled very blandly, the book is written by academics, Why Britain Voted Leave the European Union, is the production of a scholarly trio and is as dry and academic as Shipman's work is brash and journalistic. The book purports to examine the focuses which led to the examine the forces which led to the result, and does so by surveys and tables and statistics. Whereas Shipman cannot always hide his sympathies, for example his admiration for Dominic Cummings, these three writers practice a rigid code of scientific objectivity. In place of Shipman's events, dear boy, events, we have facts, Watson, facts. At times the writing sounds like that of a schoolmaster's report. On page 57 we read, regardless of the outcome, the rival campaigns could not be faulted for not trying. A significant argument of the book Brexit is that public shifts in opinion build up over time, and what seems to be a sudden swing of mood has a background, a narrative. The writers stress the valence theory of voting decisions. The term valence was introduced, according to the writers, by David Stokes, a co-author of the book Political Change in Britain. Essentially, the principle is based on the notion that there are certain subjects upon which there is strong consensus on desirability, for example, economic growth or freedom from crime. The referendum campaign was conducted in a certain sense extremely superficially, since debates hardly questioned consensus on any issue. This is an interesting point. There is a huge difference between accusing a government or system of failing to be up to the mark in relation to a valence issue, let us say ensuring growth and full employment, or trying to argue that society should have another valence-based term of reference altogether, say the observance of religious piety, or ensuring the sustainability of farming land. The Brexit referendum was focused, as the writers point out, on very few and well-defined balance criteria. The arguments on both sides were limited to a discussion of the success or lack of success of the EU in achieving a number of objectives related to these balance criteria. There is a certain artificiality about such a debate, but the artificiality could be defended on the best democratic grounds. The balance principle could be presented like this. People are shown to be worried about immigration but not race. Therefore, we talk about immigration but not about race, because there we have common ground on which to argue, namely that almost everyone wants to control immigration. The writers note that recent European immigration was discussed because, at least in Britain, not in every country, it had been established by statisticians and researchers, probably similar to the writers of Brexit, that like it or leave it, immigration had, since the Treaty of Maastricht, become a balance issue for the general public. So few people welcomed uncontrolled immigration that even politicians in favour of no limits could not say they were in favour of no limits, not at least during the referendum campaign. This wrong-footed Remainers, because the EU was seen as welcoming immigrants from all over the world, and once established somewhere within the EU, such immigrants enjoyed a right to settle in Britain. And that in addition to the free flow of workers within the EU itself. The writers put it simply. Immigration is a balance issue in the UK because an overwhelming majority of voters think that the British government should be able to control immigration, and there is a consensus that successive British governments have failed to do so. The significant conclusion a reader may infer is that a radical movement, and in one respect, the campaign to take Britain out of the EU was radical, must so far as possible both understand what balance issues currently prevail and what balance systems need to be developed in order to assist a cause. Only when a balance issue is widely settled can arguments effectively begin which refer to the failure of a system or government to fulfil what are seen as its obligations in respect of the objectives required by that balance issue. Put simply, if there is a consensus that racial differences are only skin deep, arguments against specifically coloured immigration will be mostly quite fruitless. They will be seen as cruelly discriminatory, deeply unfair, and besides the point. The same can be said of national freedom. If the balance system includes the destruction of barriers as in itself desirable, then the argument that the EU destroys national sovereignty will be ineffective, even meaningless. It seems to me, and this is not noted by the authors, although they do point to the very variable nature of voters to the perceived fulfilment or otherwise of perceived objectives in a balance system, that it will be also necessary for a radical movement to work towards the nurturing of new balance terms of reference to achieve a radical break with an old order. That subject takes us beyond the purview of an essay on two books on Brexit, but it is worth mentioning here that in the case of the Brexit debate, which makes it especially interesting as a subject of study, the referendum took place at a time when the balance issue of security was shifting from national identity to individual identity in a very significant way. The referendum broke in upon British national consciousness at a time a balance system was changing. The Brexit movement can be seen as a radical revolt to halt that shift. In other times, such a dilemma could only have been resolved by bloody civil war. One chapter of the book is devoted to the gathering by the Stronger In campaign of experts to induce the public to vote to remain. The list of experts, consultants, captains of industry, unionists and business is astonishing. They warn of the dire fate that will await the country should a majority vote for leave. The question arises, and not just in this context, how far are doom and gloom warnings earnest and honestly intended prognoses of a grim future, and to what extent are they inverted fantasies? That is to say, one should be aware that those who predict a dire outcome to taking courses of action without being mendacious in any way may deceive by stressing the importance of precisely that evidence suited to enhancing their argument. This is a temptation to employ hyperbole to raise the stakes of the argument. Hyperbole has the unwelcome side effect that it may well make those who wield it seem cranky, fringy, and, which is more damaging still, melodramatic or clownish. Cameron's speech held in the British Museum, in which he appeared to hint that a failure to remain might nudge Europe towards civil war, is an example of this. The Club of Rome's prediction in 1968 that the world oil supply would soon be exhausted is another. Hyperbole can also lead one day to a Peter and the Wolf situation and reduce popular acceptance of very real risks because those risks had been exaggerated in the past. This book also offers a warning that threats and blackmail may be counterproductive. The reader learns that the managements of Siemens and Rolls-Royce sent letters to their employees advising them of the potentially damaged consequences of voting leave. A warning letter from Airbus, as reported by Rob Davis in The Guardian of the 4th of April 2016, includes this polite threat. All of us need to keep in the back of our minds that future investments depend very much on the economic environment in which the company operates. Here again we have the dilemma of all pessimistic prognoses, distinguishing between objective and biased projections of evidence. Pessimistic evidence reinforces a belief in a negative outcome, which increases the evidence to interpret evidence in a negative light, creating a kind of vicious circle of pessimism. In the chapter entitled, Will Brexit Be a One-Off?, the writers make a very important point indeed. The Maastricht Treaty of 1992, I quote, was a turning point in this process, the writers mean leaving decisions about integration and independence to the experts. When a vote by the Danes against ratifying the treaty in a referendum held in 1993 awakened decision makers to the fact that the opinions of ordinary voters did matter when it came to furthering the integration project. The fact that in 1992 the French, who were founding members of the Maastricht Treaty, also had nearly rejected the Maastricht Treaty, signalled that things had really changed. It was around this time that the permissive consensus gave way to what became known as a constraining dissensus in Europe. Put simply, public attitudes across Europe were starting to act as a brake on the ambitions of the Eurofederalists. The people could no longer be ignored. Brexit might well have changed this constraining dissensus further into a public veto, in the sense that electorates in a number of EU member states may opt to stop any further integration occurring in the future or to roll back existing agreements. Certainly, the rapid collapse of the Schengen Agreement providing border-free travel inside the EU after the upsurge of immigration from the Middle East and Africa was largely driven by alarmed public opinion. The process of the public becoming more and more important in debates about the future of the EU has grown stronger over time. In other words, the more that people become active, the more their activity is relevant to the direction of public debate. The writers of both Brexit and All Out War interpret public policy as being more event-driven than the usual radical notion of public policy directed only by lobbies or by a sinister hidden hand. Seen in this light, activity and involvement creates its own momentum, which is not to say that there will not be immense efforts to discourage, dissuade, and destroy challenges to the one world narrative. A better argument against passivity I cannot conceive. In a passive, popularity-driven voting system, which is what Western democracy essentially is, the more confidently public opinion is manifested and accepted, the more politicians seeking election are inclined to shift their opinion in the direction of whatever issue seems to be important. Both sides in the referendum campaign were acutely aware of the importance of capturing headlines and giving an impression of what were the important issues of the day. The Brexit campaign showed that successful activism is much harder work than just declaiming or demonstrating in the streets. In the Western politics, in the Western democracies, especially in recent years, there is little encouragement for the people to become involved in politics, except as a career option. In much the same way as taking holy orders was regarded as a career option in 18th and 19th century Britain. Referenda relating to violence issues awaken interest in politics among the public. The stark nature of a stark choice converts people to politics. The turnout for the EU referendum was higher than in British general elections. A referendum debate divides people and forces them, however obliquely and for whatever reasons, to confront not persons alone, but political issues. To be sure, as I have already noted, personalities do play a considerable role in decision-making, even at a referendum. But the referendum does, by its nature, bring the merits of a course of action to the fore, rather than the merits or otherwise of a team of politicians or political leader to deal with issues. The difference is hugely significant. The referendum is not controllable in the way that elections are. It is no wonder that supporters of the EU are for the most part very hostile towards the use of a referendum to instruct public policy. After the referendum, Britain seemed to divide again, this time between the mass of voters for whom political life was a return to largely passive membership of the standard two parties, although a decidedly populist mood does seem to have entered the soul of the Labour Party, undoubtedly influenced by the mood created by the referendum. UKIP was tossed aside by the voters in the general election of 2016, with the same callousness which the electorate showed in the general election of 1945, in which they rejected Churchill in a Labour landslide. On the other hand, there have been the still ongoing attempts, amounting to treachery, of leading Remainers to overturn the result, coupled with the bungling of Leave campaigners in the face of a result which took them as much by surprise as anyone. The Cameron government had no plan B, simply had not calculated for defeat, whilst Leave campaigners seemed not to have considered for a moment what they would do if they proved victorious against the odds. The result of the referendum was therefore widespread chaos and bumbling. Joe Public, meanwhile, returned to business as normal politics, the old party loyalties of Labour and Conservative, as though nothing much had happened. It would appear, from looking at the referendum and the general election which soon followed it, that Joe Public can be inspired to defy an establishment with one gesture, but is not prepared to maintain a stance of political revolt over a long period of time. Prolonged defiance is the duty of the activist. As Tony Benn, himself a Eurosceptic from the first EU referendum, put it bluntly, "The electorate are primarily concerned with the issues which affect their lives, education, peace, jobs, security. Nobody during the course of the campaign breathed a word of the great subtext, which was race. But the intelligent and the insider knew well enough that voting Leave, while not of course a vote for ethnic separation, was a vote for the prerequisite for such separation, namely national autarky. The European Union is part of a global project to forcibly integrate, mix, and finally destroy differences between races and peoples and replace them with a utopian brotherhood of man." Did the main campaigners in the referendum know what was at stake? Opinions will differ about that, but I cannot help thinking that the impudent court jester of the European Parliament, Nigel Farage, knew what he was doing when he unveiled that anti-migrant poster, Breaking Point, and his enemies surely knew what he was doing too, more than cynically playing the race card, which is why he was reported to police and the do-gooders howled racist. And how uncanny, then, the event that seemed to show what happens when you go down that sorry road, the murder of Joe Cox, which followed within hours of the displaying of the posters. When the Leave campaign talked of winning back control, it was a head raised above the parapet. Others may interpret it differently. Maybe the entire referendum campaign should be taken at face value after all, the balance issues followed more or less blindly by all and sundry, and maybe the Leave campaign really did not, in any way, intend to evoke old dreams of ethnic homogeneity, but was simply presenting the case for economic self-determination. Maybe. However, of one thing I am sure, and that is that the referendum result did not belong to the projections of the world's most powerful. It was not part of the One World Plan. Events, dear boy. Events.